All right, so we're looking at old age, sickness, and death, something many of us don't really like to do all that often. And I wasn't able to be here, but I'm told that Tony Bernhard talked about the four messengers, four divine, or the four heavenly messengers last week. Yeah, so I'll sort of be structuring the talk around that. And this story of the four messengers is sometimes used as a teaching story, as if it were the Buddha that actually experienced that, the historical Buddha that experienced that. Actually, it's a teaching story. When you go through the Pali Canon, which is the ancient texts that hold the teachings of the Buddha, the Buddha tells this story about another, a previous Buddha. But it's a beautiful myth, a beautiful story about a young, privileged person leaving that safety of that environment and encountering an old person, a sick person, and a corpse, and sort of being moved to leave that privileged environment and find out what life was all about. And another version of the story, there's a fourth messenger, which is a wandering mendicant or a monk that holds the possibility with his serene countenance and his calm being of another way, of a way of freedom. So Bhikkhu Bodhi has written a beautiful passage about these divine messengers. He says, "We share with the young prince Siddhartha a blissful and often willful oblivion to stark realities that are constantly thrusting themselves to our attention. If the Dhamma is to be more than the bland, humdrum background of a comfortable life, if it is to become the inspiring, sometimes grating voice that steers us on to the great path of awakening, we ourselves must emulate the Bodhisattva in his process of maturation. We must join him on that journey outside the palace walls, the walls of our own self-assuring preconceptions, and see for ourselves the divine messengers we so often miss because our eyes are fixed on more important things, that is, on our mundane preoccupations and goals." So the Buddha actually recommended that we reflect on these things frequently. And so this practice is called the five subjects for frequent reflection, or the five daily recollections. And this is actually in the Pali Canon as something that the Buddha taught. And this is how he taught it. "There are these five facts that one should reflect on often, whether one is a woman or a man." And this is Tanisaro Bhikkhu's translation from about 1995. So knowing Tanisaro Bhikkhu and how orthodox he is, I don't think this is somebody modern putting in the gender-neutral language. I think this is actually what the Buddha said. "There are these five facts that one should reflect on often, whether one is a woman or a man, lay or ordained. Which five? I am subject to aging, have not gone beyond aging. This is the first fact that one should reflect on often, whether one is a woman or a man, lay or ordained. I am subject to illness, have not gone beyond illness. This is the second fact that one should reflect on often, whether one is a woman or a man, lay or ordained. I am subject to death, have not gone beyond death. This is the third fact that one should reflect on often, whether one is a woman or a man, lay or ordained. I will grow different, separate from all that is dear and appealing to me. This is the fourth fact that one should reflect on often, whether one is a woman or a man, lay or ordained. I am the owner of my actions, heir to my actions, born of my actions, related through my actions, and have my actions as my arbitrator. Whatever I do for good or evil, to that will I fall heir. This is the fifth fact that one should reflect on often, whether one is a woman or a man, lay or ordained. These are the five facts that one should reflect on often. And many of us do bring these to mind daily or frequently. If you do, you may have your own version of it. When I say, I will grow different, separate from all that is dear to me, I say, all that is dear and appealing to me will someday be otherwise. And then the owner of my actions, I also add, my happiness or unhappiness depend on my actions, not on my wishes for myself or on anybody else's wishes for me. So it's kind of an overview of these as they're seen as a collective. So let's start with old age. So a history buff friend of mine has this technique that's really informative for historical perspective. So what he does is he takes an event, and however far you are from that event, you figure out how far that event is from one that precedes it by the same number of years. So today I'm 67 years old. So if we take my birth date, 1951, we subtract 67, that puts us 1884. Just a few years before my grandfather came to the United States from Costa Rica. What was going on in 1884? The first long-distance telephone call from Boston to New York. Susan B. Anthony addressed the U.S. House Judiciary Committee, and Dianne Feinstein was not on that committee, arguing for an amendment to the U.S. Constitution granting women the right to vote. Now, the 19th Amendment was finally passed in 1920, right? So here she is in 1884. Well, guess what? That was first introduced 16 years before that, in 1868. That's how long it took to pass. Speaking of injustice, the U.S. Congress accepted the Second Chinese Exclusion Act. 1884, thank you for building the Transcontinental Railroad. Now, get out. Construction began on Chicago's first skyscraper, 10 stories. It was a skyscraper at the time. First roller coaster at Coney Island. This will give you some perspective on how long ago this was. Congressman John Lynch, a Republican from Mississippi, is the first black elected chairman of the Republican Convention. Reconstruction, right? Before the backlash. So we had black Republicans in Mississippi in 1884. The party of Lincoln. It was still the party of Lincoln, right? Oh, his candidate lost. Grover Cleveland was elected. And the Statue of Liberty was presented to the United States in Paris. And then they put in the cornerstone. It wasn't finished that year. And the capstone was set atop the Washington Monument. So that just gives you an idea of the space of time that we're talking about here. And I think it's helpful. In one sense, you know, our lives pass in a flash. And in another sense, because we put ourselves at the center of the universe, our lives last forever, right? The universe begins when we're born. We have all this consciousness, all of these thoughts, all these things go through our head. And then we die and the universe ends. That's it, right? That's a nihilistic view that the Buddha warned us against. But I mean, for many of us, that's kind of how it goes. So while we're talking about old age, let's look at life expectancy. So in 1980, the richest cohort of middle-aged American men could expect to live till they were about 83, and the poorest could be expected to live till they were 76. By 2010, the richest American males had gained 6 years on life expectancy. The poorest had stayed the same. The difference between the top 1% of men and the bottom is 15 years life expectancy. For women, it's 10 years. The life expectancy in 2011, expectancy at birth, so I think some of you know, like, if you can make it to 40, you're probably going to live longer. If you can make it to 65, you're going to live even longer. But this is life expectancy at birth now, so everything's being factored in. 2011, life expectancy at birth was about 79 for the total U.S. population, 78.7. It's called 79. For non-Hispanic black males, it was 72. So 7 years. 7 years difference. So life expectancy. It's not the same for everyone. Let's look at sickness. One of the most amazing books that's come out about old age, sickness, and death is this book by a neurosurgeon named Paul Kalanithi, When Breath Becomes Air. That's what he says about sickness. The tricky part of illness is that as you go through it, your values are constantly changing. You try to figure out what matters to you, and then you keep figuring it out. It felt like someone had taken away, this is after his diagnosis with lung cancer. It felt like someone had taken away my credit card, and I was having to learn how to budget. You may decide you want to spend your time working as a neurosurgeon, but 2 months later, you may feel differently. 2 months after that, you may want to learn to play the saxophone or devote yourself to the church. Death may be a one-time event, but living with terminal illness is a process. Grand illnesses are supposed to be life-clarifying. Instead, I knew I was going to die, but I'd known that before. My state of knowledge was the same, but my ability to make lunch plans had been shot to hell. The way forward would seem obvious if only I knew how many months or years I had left. Tell me 3 months, I'd spend time with my family. Tell me 1 year, I'd write a book. He didn't have a year, but he still wrote the book. Give me 10 years, I'd get back to treating diseases. The truth that you live one day at a time didn't help. What was I supposed to do with that day? This day. What are we supposed to do? I've been diagnosed with a condition. About 2% of people over 50 have it, and it's unpronounceable, but the acronym is MGUS, and the last two words, US, stand for undetermined significance. So it reminds me when my daughter was first diagnosed, my daughter that's currently diagnosed as autistic, she was diagnosed as pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified, otherwise known as, we have no clue. So this thing shows up as a protein in the blood. I used to get blood all the time, so I got this ominous note from the blood bank that said, you might want to get yourself checked out. Show this profile to your primary physician. So I did, and I have this condition. So about 2% of people over 50 have it. About 1% of those develops into multiple myeloma. So undetermined significance. And there's at least one other member of this community that has this condition. And so, like Paul, I know I'm going to die. We all are. But what am I going to do with this day? And undetermined significance. I mean, all of our lives are filled with undetermined significance. So one of the things this practice does is it allows us to sit with uncertainty, I think, at a level that we couldn't before, because when we look at anything, we realize it's not solid. That nothing is certain. The next breath isn't certain. I mean, I have pauses on the, I don't pause at all on the in-breath. I don't have any pause at all. It's weird. So it goes, but sometimes after the out-breath, I'll pause for a long time to the point where I'm sitting there thinking, huh, this is interesting. I wonder when the next one's coming, you know? Nothing's certain, not even the next breath. So if we can live with that awareness, not let it bog us down, not let us, let it put us into depression, but if we can live with that awareness, it really does inform our life. And one of the poems that captures that best, that living with that awareness, is called Otherwise, which I think is part of the reason I love to say when I do the five reflections, someday it will all be otherwise, because of this poem by Jane Kenyon, which has been one of my favorites for years. This was written after she was diagnosed with salivary gland cancer and her husband had his first bout of cancer, which he eventually died of. Otherwise, by Jane Kenyon. I got out of bed on two strong legs. It might have been otherwise. I ate cereal, sweet milk, ripe, flawless peach. It might have been otherwise. I took the dog uphill to the birch wood. All morning I did the work I love. At noon, I lay down with my mate. It might have been otherwise. We ate dinner together at a table with silver candlesticks. It might have been otherwise. I slept in a bed in a room with paintings on the walls and planned another day just like this day. But one day, I know, it will be otherwise. Remind me next time, with these aging eyes, not to print in 8-point font. So I keep taking my glasses on. I need to take them off to read this. So several of us at various levels are students of Steve Armstrong. And in February, he was putting some prayer flags up at his sanctuary on Maui and lost the ability to speak coherently. And a couple weeks later, had brain surgery to remove a tumor. It's known as a glioblastoma multiform. I'm probably pronouncing it wrong, but you get the idea. It's pretty nasty. He's now in treatment. He's in the fifth of 6 weeks of chemo and radiation. And as he says, I'm not a statistic yet, but the statistics are that if you get treatment for this, on average, you've got 14 months to live. So you can go on to Caring Bridge and read his posts, and these are taken from his public posts on Caring Bridge. There is an unforced natural equanimity and a very wide or long perspective of all that happens in the world. everything is seen through the lens of all that happens is due to the minds and actions of the actors. It will all pass. It has been a gradual evolution of an initial singular preoccupation with my condition, my disease, my prognosis, my eventual death, and all that goes with self-involvement, justification, identification, defensiveness, a kind of denial, minimizing and closed-mindedness to other ideas and suggestions, assumptions, reminders, etc. But just after my surgery, back home, not fully back in the body-mind, somehow in that space of mind, I knew that I didn't want to just disappear, fading away, without seeing Kamala again, who was on the mainland teaching. That's Kamala Masters. That was when I began to realize that others are going with me on this journey into what conditions out of my control is going to offer. I began to be aware and care how my heart, mind, decisions, and relationships to my caregivers was going to impact me as much as my condition will be affecting them. That interdependence, huh? My motivation in continued living became compassion toward others. Now, after reading that, I was kind of noodling around the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, and you can do that for weeks. It's in the Digha Nikaya, which are the long discourses, and this is the longest of the long discourses. This is the longest sutta in the Pali Canon. It goes on and on about all kinds of things. But I was reading through that, and I found this passage from the Buddha, which is amazingly similar to what Steve just expressed. But when the Blessed One had... this is a translation by Sister Vajira and Francis Story, Digha Nikaya 16. But when the Blessed One had entered upon the rainy season, there arose in him a severe illness, and sharp and deadly pains came upon him. And the Blessed One endured them mindfully, clearly comprehending and unperturbed. Then it occurred to the Blessed One, it would not be fitting if I came to my final passing away without addressing those who attended on me, without taking leave of the community of bhikkhus. Then let me suppress this illness by strength of will, resolve to maintain the life process, and live on. Then we come to death. And we're only supposed to teach from this seat from experience, and I don't have that experience. But I can share with you the wisdom of a couple of other folks that have been close to it. First, again, is from Paul Kalanithi. The lung cancer diagnosis was confirmed. My carefully planned and hard-won future no longer existed. Death, so familiar to me in my work, was now paying a personal visit. Here we were, finally face to face, and yet nothing about it seemed recognizable. Standing at the crossroads where I should have been able to see and follow the footprints of the countless patients I had treated over the years, I saw instead only a blank, a harsh, vacant, gleaming white desert, as if a sandstorm had erased all trace of familiarity. And this one by Daniel Berrigan, who knew a thing or two about death as well. Title is, You Finish It, I Can't. Oh, by the way, these poems, the Jane Kenyon and this one by Daniel Berrigan, are in a book called Poems to Live By in Uncertain Times. And it was not published yesterday, was published in the aftermath of September 11, 2001. This woman, Joan Murray is the editor. She was on a train in New York City. Her poem about that experience, and there were some first responders in the seats across from her in the subway. And her poem about them is in here. It's awesome. So this is a signed copy. I went to a reading of hers on June 22nd, 2002. This is the poem. It's short, but infinite. You finish it, I can't. The world is somewhere visibly round, perfectly lighted, firm, free in space. But why men die like kings or sick animals? Why tears stand in living faces? Why one forgets the color of the eyes of the dead? You finish it, I can't. The fourth messenger was the wandering ascetic. And what that means for our practice is that these things are unbearable, old age, sickness, and death, in the conventional sense. It's the reason we don't want to frequently recollect them. They're unbearable in the context of, as Bhikkhu Bodhi put it, this mundane comfort that we so often seek as the purpose for our life. But when we come to this practice and we realize that there's a way of approaching life that is much deeper than running after the pleasant and running away from the unpleasant, our life sort of comes into a perspective that allows space for these things to come in and to be accepted. Here's what Bhikkhu Bodhi has to say about it. If in this process of awakening we must meet old age, sickness, and death face to face, that is because the place of safety can be reached only by honest confrontation with the stark truths about human existence. When, however, we do look at the divine messengers squarely, without embarrassment or fear, we will find that their faces undergo an unexpected metamorphosis. Before our eyes, by subtle degrees, they change into another face, the face of the Buddha, with its serene smile of triumph over the army of Mara, over the demons of desire and death. The divine messengers point to what lies beyond the transient, to a dimension of reality where there is no more aging, no more sickness, and no more death. This is the goal and final destination of the Buddhist path, Nibbana, the unaging, the unailing, the deathless. It is to direct us there that the divine messengers have appeared in our midst, and the good news of deliverance is their message. So that's about all I have to share tonight. We have time for some comments, reflections, objections. Fred, could we maybe get a mic, please?
Hello? Okay. So the last thing that you said about, like, the goal, it seems like that's a total contradiction to the first things that you were saying, you know, that these things are coming, right? Death and all that. So it seems to me like my personal practice, thinking about the goal is very unproductive because it's denial of things that are real. Mm-hmm. So what's the way to deal with that kind of contradiction that I'm talking about?
Right. Yeah, great question. It's important to take something like the teaching of Nibbana at whatever level we understand it in our current practice. And as I understand it in my current practice, it's about freedom from greed, hatred, and delusion in this lifetime. So we're using our practice in a way that allows us to have less attachment to this body as being ourselves, to our preconceived notions as being ourselves, and that by lessening that attachment, by kind of loosening the sense of self, by the other realizations of insight, the three characteristics that we're trying to realize with this practice of impermanence, of the reality of dukkha, and of anatta, the loosening of the self, by doing that, we're actually going to be able to go through these experiences of old age, sickness, and death with in a more skillful manner. That's how I frame it for myself. Now, for each of us, it might be different. But just understanding that Nibbana is a verb. So none of us should be holding the misconception that it's a place. It's a heaven or some physical realm that, you know, something's going to after death. That's not it. At some level, it's a verb. It's a process. It's a way of being. So that's how I hold it. I don't subscribe to the metaphysical religious aspects of Buddhism for myself. I see it as a way of learning to live more skillfully in this world, in this lifetime. That's how I hold it. And in that sense, it's less contradictory because we're talking about another reality that's achievable. And as Steve Armstrong says, it's possible. It's actually possible to lessen our own suffering. It's hard for me to picture being completely free of suffering, but certainly possible to experience less suffering. I think many of us have felt that at some point in our practice, that, yeah, suffering a little bit less, still having unskillful mind states, but they're not as frequent or they're not as intense and that sort of thing. And seeing that as the path, you know, and the goal, you're right, I mean, that word, in this goal-oriented society, is a little bit too concrete and open to being desired and grasped at. But if we think of it as an aspiration, a sort of airy thing that's way off in the distance, understanding that, you know, as Dennis Warren, the illustration he always uses, is that the Mars Explorer, in getting to Mars, traveled all those millions of miles and was off course 98% of the time, with constant course correction. And so it is in our practice. You know, there's this aspiration of this distant thing, freedom from suffering. On the way, we're wavering, we're off course, maybe not 98% of the time, but a lot, constantly making course corrections, and eventually come to a place where our suffering has lessened enough that we don't have to be all tight and grasping around the concept of, oh, I hope I don't get sick. Oh, boy. I'm getting old, it's terrible. And, you know, this fear of death that would come along with those kind of grasping attitudes. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question. By the way, you're being recorded.
Oh boy. Especially since I don't really know how to frame this. But when you were talking, what I've learned about practice has something to do with holding and being able to be present for heartbreak. And there's a certain kind of a certain part of my practice where when these things happen that are really painful, like the potential in my case now of losing a loved one, but I have lost loved ones in the past, and how intensely painful that is, but through practice, not telling in the being able to tell in the body when I'm pushing that away, mm-hmm. and over time there's more resilience. And what I'm thinking is that I practice with the recollections every day, that they hit me in different ways at different mm-hmm. times, and they feel very big still and unfathomable for me. But when I catch glimpses of them, I work with it in the body and the mind and my heart. And I'm hoping, I guess. I mean, I think that's part of the practice, because this stuff happens all the time. And it's the anticipation, the worry, all the add-ons that I think I have just been able to scare myself crazy in the past. And less and less now, as I can just stay with the momentary shifting feelings around those things.
Right.
And find that I actually can do that.
Right. So, thank you. Yeah, it's been said that Vipassana is a constant grieving process.
Yeah.
It's a constant training in grief. Because we're letting go of things, right?
Yeah.
One thing after another. And so all of these processes, old age, sickness, and death, they're all letting go of something.
They're letting go, and like when you were reading the poem about the woman who had dinner with her husband and things like that, they're also really feeling the sweetness of yeah. those things in light of their impermanence.
Right.
It just, it's very full.
Right.
Hard to know when you would. Right now, death has been present in my life in a significant way, but it always has. I had the opportunity to be visited by what I call now death. When I was 9, not an unusual time for that awareness to be present for the young mind, the young developing child. And for the next 40 years, I had it visit me, well, at least for the next 15 years, every night when I would sleep. And it offered very, very confusing and very compelling and very frightening. But I feel that I was blessed in many ways by having this. And I don't really believe, I mean, I like to use the word bless. I love the word. We don't use it in this tradition very much. But it does feel like grace and blessing is something that, I don't know, that feels accessible. And so even though it was just like we all experience something that we know can't be compared to almost anything because it's so difficult, so hard. It's just, we just have no choice but to go there, and we have to be with it. And that's what it asked of me. I had no choice. You can't let it go. It's fully present. And so there's just this remarkable ability that we have to take it on. And, you know, we have these new wonderful people that come here. It's so exciting to talk to these. Spencer has just come to the center here with us, and it was fascinating to talk to him. And because it's this is such a world, you know, of growing, so exciting. And I don't know. I don't have any question. I just and then we had this great opportunity to have our beloved Diane, you know, just really bring this to our Sangha. And that was important for all of us. So I don't.
So, I appreciated your answer to the first question and the kind of review of the benefits of practice. And, you know, the term equanimity comes about for me. I do the reflections, not every day, but often. And I do them, I've said this before in this group, I do them in different, with different words at various times. And so, and each time, it brings up a new awareness on each of the reflections. And that's important. I mean, that's just part of an ongoing practice to kind of understand or come, you know, kind of get a little more real with what this practice, this sitting practice that we have, this weekly practice that we have here is. So I can't pass up the opportunity to make a little recommendation here. Go on to Caring Bridge website and look up, I think it's under Stephen K. Armstrong, and read his blogs. So there's been 3 or 4 pretty good ones. I mean, not pretty good ones, but there's a lot of comments too, but each one of them is fantastic. It's fascinating because this is a man who's been practicing for all these years, and he's got this diagnosis, and he knows his death is coming, and he's still teaching through his blog, and he's still practicing through it, and it's beautiful. I mean, it's just beautiful to read and see and feel. So, yeah, I mean, not if you're interested. Just go and do it if you practice, because it's a real enhancement to practice. You're up.
I live with 10 medical conditions, and it's no fun. And eventually, one of them's going to get me if something else doesn't come along. And I was given much advice back in 1997 about, well, first of all, they weren't sure how long I would live. Then they thought they could get me 10 or 12 years. Well, that's come and gone. A lot of advice about getting rid of toxic relationships, avoiding stress, many things like that. And I can't say it was bad advice. On the other hand, life is stressful. And I guess the point where I'm really going on this is, because otherwise there's too many tangents, why should I care about being skillful around death?
Well, most people want to be happy. And all skillful means is, the word skillful in this context, all that means is that we want to incline our mind toward behaviors that will make us and the people around us happy and away from the behaviors that will make us and the people around us miserable. So With a few minor exceptions, there aren't many folks out there that are really interested or motivated by making themselves and others miserable. So, I can't tell you to care about anything, but when I use the word skillful in this context, that's what I'm talking about, just thoughts, speech, and behavior that makes us and the people around us happier.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Hi. I'm not really sure. I've been thinking about it, some issues regarding this for a while now. I've talked to you in the past couple months about some of them. The one thing that every time this conversation seems to come up, there's a bit of a conflict that I have. Several of the teachers that I've followed and have described life and death as being one or being the same, so that the idea that we're moving through life to a final death is sort of kind of an anachronism to me. It seems like we're all actually dying every moment that we're alive. Mm-hmm. And it just seems to me that when we get that reminder of getting sick, we're like, you know, when that point, I know, you know, when we're really sick and we're like, are we going to make it through this experience? It's just a quick reminder that, hey, parts of us are dying all the time. We always have to deal with that all the time. And I don't mean to be disrespectful to anyone. I realize that probably people are in different places with this than I am, but the folks that I have known that have died recently and in my life, many of them, and I lost with them, but in their dying, the only thing they lost was pain. And I said, honestly, rest in peace, because, you know, it was a benefit for them. So, you know, I'm not saying that you shouldn't grieve your loss of someone in your life, but realize that maybe it isn't the worst thing that could happen, that maybe it isn't something that's not happening all the time anyway. Just a thought.
Thank you. Thanks for that reminder.
I just wanted to add a little bit to what Jerry was saying about the Steve Armstrong's Caringbridge site. I felt quite self-centered response to some of the things he wrote, because, you know, this disease is actually attacking his mind, and I think I had misunderstood that I would always have my mind to help me be more equanimous with whatever's going on with me. And some of the experiences that he describes, he can't even figure out what's going on with his sense door input. You know, he hears something and he can tell it's a sound, but he can't tell if it's the trees or birds or. And for me, the really profound thing about that was you can really clearly see the benefit of his practice, because he's still able to approach that experience with interest and curiosity and some level of calm. I'm sure he doesn't necessarily describe his worst moments, but it's like, this is still a pretty opened up, not closed down mind, even though he's going through this experience, which personally to me sounds extremely terrifying. So if you ever had any doubt about the benefit of practice, I mean, I've always looked at Steve and said, whatever you've got, I want some of that. But this is another instance where he is very clearly showing that in a quite open way for the whole world to look at if you want to read his stuff. So it's really powerful stuff if you want to take a look at it.
Without the microphone, it feels like a privilege. It feels like, the biggest teaching of his life, it seems to me, in some ways, you know, and I just feel so honored, you know, that he's, he's fulfilling, you know, being a benefit for others in an enormous way. Because we have worked with this, all of us have worked with this all of our lives, some more than others. And, it's encourage everyone to go and look and read. Because it won't be there, you know.
So let's just take a moment to check the state of our heart. Noticing how all the words land within the heart, mind, and body. Noticing any areas of tension or holding. Bringing some kindness. Gently allowing that to release. Coming back to the breath. This breath and the next. The breath that has been there since we were born and someday will be otherwise. Sensing the sincere intention of all those here to serve others with their practice. To understand the interdependent nature of our practice, our lives, the potential to, in some real way, reduce the suffering of other beings. So gathering that energy and offering it with the sincere intention that what we do here, whether tonight or at other times in community, it's truly not for ourselves, but for the benefit of all beings. All beings who, just like us, want to be happy, offering the unbounded attitude of friendliness and care, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be safe and protected, peaceful and happy. May all beings be as healthy and as strong as their current circumstances allow. May all beings experience ease in some real way in their lives. And through this practice and our dedication to it, may all beings be free of suffering. Thank you for your practice.